disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This Is America, March 15th, 2019. This episode, we speak to a network of families who have come together to fight ongoing gladiator fights facilitated by prison staff in Central California prisons. We then turn towards addressing first feedback to our last episode, and then discuss how political parties, activist groups, and the media have created a culture of never-ending campaigning, which has also engendered the growth of far-right grifters. We then discuss the recent CPAC conference and what this means for both the future of the right, as well as its implications for autonomous social movements. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. Sadly, Thursday, March 14th, as thousands of young people were walking out of class in Australia and New Zealand, part of ongoing student actions against climate change, a shooter walked into a New Zealand mosque and opened fire. There are reports of more than one shooting and also of bombs being found in the cars left outside of the mosque. At the time of this recording, authorities say they have apprehended at least three men and one woman in connection to the shootings. At this time, many journalists on social media are reporting information that has been found on a series of online profiles. So far, it has been reported that at least one of the killers posted to a far-right message board, 8chan, right before the shooting began and uploaded a manifesto. The manifesto praises Trump for bringing about a sense of white identity, calls non-whites and Muslims invaders, and also claims that the alt-right needs to get off the internet and start fighting back. A Facebook and Twitter page under the name Brenton Tarrant also uploaded a live stream to the shooting itself, which shows a man with multiple high-range and high-power firearms pulling up outside of a mosque, walking inside, and then opening fire on dozens of people inside that are praying. These images match others that were posted to Twitter and show similar images of a man armed with multiple high-power machine guns with writings written over the bullet clips, including various alt-right and neo-Nazi slogans and symbols, including the 14 words. The suspected shooter also posted a picture of his vest, which included a black sun patch, an image popular within the alt-right and white nationalism. In his manifesto, Tarrant praises Candace Owens of Turning Point USA for radicalizing him, and also right before the shooting began in the video encourages people to subscribe to Pew Pew Die Die, a YouTube video game streamer that had helped popularize the alt-right. So in many ways, this is a mass shooting made by the alt-right and for the alt-right. What the ramifications of this newest mass killing will be is anyone's guess. Hopefully this horrific act will show more people, just as the Pittsburgh attack did, that the alt-right is just not keen to sit back and glorify violence in the form of helicopter memes from the safety of their own homes on the internet, that some of them will and are carrying out acts of terror. Moreover, those that peddle conspiracy theories of the impending white genocide or breeding out of whites from their, quote, homelands, need to be held accountable, from Alex Jones to Tucker Carlson, for the growing fear in so many that violence is the only way to stop this. In other news, in Portland, Oregon, the Burgerville Workers Union of the Industrial Workers of the World announced that two more fast food restaurants of the Burgerville chain are now going public with the union and soon will be filing to have the union recognized in their workplaces. This move is happening when Burgerville Corporate continues to fight with the union in contract negotiations, and the Burgerville Workers Union continues to call for a boycott of Burgerville stores. In response to more workers joining the growing fast food insurgency, Burgerville has also pushed back. As the union reported on Facebook, quote, yesterday, while convention center workers were fined for union elections with the NLRB, managers began their union-busting campaign by retaliating against and disciplining 8 pro-union workers. They are deeply saddened but unsurprised by Burgerville's continued commitment to union-busting. One worker, Marisha, who is due to go on maternity leave today, was suspended for forgetting her name tag, even after a manager gave her a new one. Furthermore, Marisha reports that her general manager told her that he would be treating union members differently now, a blatant violation of labor law. I honestly feel like Matthew is targeting the people in the union, Marisha says. Ever since we filed on the petition, he's been treating us very differently. Other disciplinary actions, including suspensions and write-ups, have been taken against pro-union workers. These actions are alarming, but they are just another event in an unbroken chain of union busting that has gone on for years. Burgerville workers live under a culture of fear. This is especially true at the Convention Center Burgerville, which has had a massive turnover rate as the result of brutal working conditions and hateful management. Stay tuned for more updates as workers get ready for their union election and follow the hashtag BoycottBurgerville. In prison news, there's been a series of prison uprisings since the start of March, reports Perilous Chronicle. On March 11th, it was reported an uprising took place at the Maui Correction Center. At least 42 prisoners refused to turn to their cells at the end of the recreation time and instead caused significant damage to prison infrastructure. The uprising occurred in two pods of the housing unit. Prisoners broke sprinklers, leading to flooding in the pod. The prisoners also started a fire, which caused smoke damage in the neighboring pod. The head of the Public Safety Department linked the uprising to the effects of overcrowding. Quote, I'm sure that generally speaking, the overcrowding in the institution was a major contributor. On March 8th, it was reported that there was an uprising at the Crawford County Detention Center in Arkansas. Quote, when a sergeant and a deputy attempted to remove a prisoner from a pod containing 40 prisoners, the other 39 prisoners interfered. When the prisoner was removed, the rest of the prisoners attacked prison infrastructure, destroying televisions, lights, ceiling tiles, phones, and the sprinkler system, which caused significant flooding. Finally, on March 4th, brawls and clashes broke out between youth inmates and guards at the Hills Youth Family Services Facility in Minnesota. Lastly, along the border, resistance to construction of Trump's border wall is heating up. Here's a post from Facebook from the Carrizo Tribe of Texas. The Carrizo Tribe is leading the opposition to Mr. Trump's border wall. Their mission is to witness the construction of the wall and report the damage it is causing. As the tribe protects sacred sites from destruction, they also educate people on the impact of the wall it is having on people and animals living in the shadow. To meet the mission, the tribe established a series of village encampments along the wall's path, and your help is now essential. You are being asked to donate supplies to their ongoing efforts. The Carrizo tribe established their second frontline encampment along the southern border. This one is located within the National Butterfly Center. The encampment, Mariposa, is requesting some specific items of need. Please consider helping us meet these needs. In our show notes, you can also see a link to their Amazon wishlist as well as their PayPal where you can donate. That's going to do it for us this week. Thank you for listening. Please enjoy the discussions and the interview, and we will see you soon.
Come on, come on. Come on, come on. Come on, come on. Antifa.
Yes, I'm Ruby Gradias, and I'm with the Corcoran 3C support group. Well, what's happening is that they're trying to integrate yards by putting two different groups, opposing groups that don't really program together on the yard, and the system is very well aware that they don't program together, but they're trying to forcefully have them program together, which are causing fights. And that's why they're out here protesting. Because of this, these fights, they're on what they call modified program, which we're calling a lockdown, because they're not able to receive any type of commissary, no visits, no phone calls, no rehabilitation, no classes, nothing. So that's why we're here, you know, because we want their human rights restored. You know, as inmates, they still have rights, and we're here standing and protesting, standing with them, believing that, you know, we can make a change and help them restore what they're entitled to. My personal opinion, I can't speak for anyone else, I can't speak for the inmates, but my personal opinion is, if you work for CDCR, you're aware of how a prison is ran. You know that certain groups do not get along, not just now, but from the beginning of time. And you're trying to put them on the yard together, there's not going to be nothing but problems. And you're aware of that. If you work for CDCR, you're aware of that. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, we've spoken to people, COs, and they are very, very, a lot of them say that it's something that they're not trying to do, but it's coming from headquarters. And you know, they're aware. They're very well aware of what happens when you put two opposing groups together. You know, there's going to be a fight anywhere, on the streets, in prison, anywhere, north and south, you know, anywhere, it's going to happen. The hunger strike that took place in Corcoran was basically to have the demands met. They had six demands that they wanted met, which they went on a hunger strike to have those demands met, which the warden agreed to two out of the six demands. And once the hunger strike was over, the warden reneged, and that, you know, of course, put them back in the same situation. These incrementals is what they're called, incremental releases. What happens is they pick people. According to CDCR, when you call or you emails, we have emails stating that the way they pick people for these incremental releases are people with the lowest points from both groups, and they bring them out to the yard. And they're saying is that they're trying to see if they're ready to program. You can't just throw somebody in a yard and expect them to program if they've never done it before. So this is what the incremental release is. It has nothing to do with the hunger strike. This has been going on. The incremental releases have been going on before the hunger strike happened. The hunger strike was basically to get the demands met. The reason that they went on lockdown was because of a riot that took place. The riot took place in early September. They went on lockdown in the end of September and have been on lockdown. Now, according to the policy, rules and regulation for CDCR, according to the DOME, the Department Operation Manual, they're only allowed to be on lockdown for 2 weeks at a time. So what they do is they allow them to be on lockdown for 2 weeks, lift the lockdown, put two and two out there again, a fight occurs, back on lockdown, so that they have, you know, a legit reason for keeping them on lockdown. And that's what they're doing. Our group, Corcoran Group, have been protesting. We've been on lockdown, like I said, since September. They went on lockdown here on the 18th, here at Soledad, and they heard about what was happening. So a lot of these women went to support us. And so by them supporting us, when they went on lockdown, now we're here to support them. Because, you know, in the long run, we all are people who have someone that's a loved one on the other side. We're going to continue to protest. We have to, you know, until our point is made and people begin to listen, we're going to protest. And not just here, but we're going to go to Sacramento. We're going to go to CDCR headquarters, because this has to stop. It has to stop. I understand. We see posts about they're criminals. This is what happens when you commit a crime. That's understandable. I agree. When you're a criminal, your freedom that's taken from you, that's the payment of that. That's how you pay for your crime. But when you begin to jeopardize the safety and security of an inmate, then that's when you cross the line. But yes, we will continue to protest, and we're going to continue to do what we have to do to stand for our loved ones.
Stop gladiator fights! Stop!
Gladiator fights!
Stop!
Gladiator fights!
Stop!
Gladiator fights!
Dee Cruz, I am with the Soledad State Prison Organizing Group. I feel it went well. We are getting a lot more support, including, you know, a couple correctional officers are giving the thumbs up. It went really well. We told CDCR what why we're here and why we will continue to come here. The main message is to tell CDCR administration to stop the integration between SNY and GP inmates, the integration of known enemies, specifically in Soledad State Prison, the separation of the Bulldog population for everybody's safety and everybody's safety, including correctional officers. Gladiator fights are a term we are using as family members. It goes back to the 1990s gladiator fights where correctional officers were betting on inmates when they were being placed in the yard or in the yard to basically fight with their enemies. So the CDCR is calling them incremental releases. We are calling them gladiator fights because that is exactly what is going on in today's Central Valley prisons. CDCR is knowingly and intentionally putting known enemies out in the yard, out in segregated places. For example, in Soledad State Prison, they will be putting our loved ones in the gym. So we're calling that a gladiator ring. So they are creating an environment for our loved ones to basically kill each other. I actually think this is one way, a twist to the SHU incident. Our loved ones came out of the security housing units, and now CDCR is creating and promoting violence so that they can tell the public and everybody else, look, these guys are not programming and they are creating violence. So by them creating violence, they're basically saying our loved ones are a failure and they are dangerous and they should go back to the SHU. So they are creating the violence. We're trying to stop it. If they would just separate the individuals that should not be together, it would be peaceful. We are absolutely growing and we will continue to grow. We will not stop. We're here, Soledad State Prison. We have Corcoran State Prison loved ones. We help each other out. We're gonna be helping Pleasant Valley hopefully soon. So everybody that's being affected by this, by the integration, for either the Bulldog situation or the SNY and GP inmate population, we are all coming together and helping each other in your own designated prison, including in Sacramento. We have a no non-designated programming facility Facebook page. They can also get in contact with me personally. I can give out my email address. It's D as in dog, H-E-R-R. ER47@gmail.com. I can provide any type of information they need and keep them updated as to where we are organizing next. CDCR is listening. I would just like to say to CDCR to follow their own mission statement, their own policies and procedures in regards to safety and security of our incarcerated loved ones. They have an obligation. They took an oath to protect our loved ones, and they are doing the exact opposite.
Okay, we are back here for another week. Before we get started, we have a lot of stuff to cover today. We're going to try to address very quickly a letter that we got. It's entitled A Future in Deserts, and in response to, I believe, last week's show where we discussed, at least in part or in passing, the book Desert. The message reads, in a recent episode in This Is America, you mentioned that the dream of a revolution where we take the means of production and save the climate isn't feasible anymore. After reading Desert myself, I still don't understand the scope of the destruction we are going to deal with. Should we expect, for example, one, a climate feedback loop
that will turn the Earth into a Mad Max situation. Two, a global migration crisis where large areas of the world are abandoned, where migration causes a capitalist crisis. Or three, a situation that's not so dire, where environmental disasters are more sporadic. Definitely, it will be a mix of some of the above. What could we expect the future to look like, and what actions should we take to prepare ourselves or even mitigate the upcoming disasters?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I want to state that I think it's imperative that we continue to do the things that we do. I mean, as we talked about last week, the anti-pipeline movement or water protector movement has had, you know, huge implications. I think obviously we want to do everything we can to not make it worse, and that we also want to mobilize people to take action, because, you know, social movements are the incubator of, you know, the world to come in many ways, and that by participating in those things, you know, hopefully people are going to get ready for what's going to happen. I think the main point that I would make is that climate change is already happening, and that therefore the idea that we're going to, quote, save the world, or that, you know, we're going to stop something from unfolding is just not true. Like, we're going to have to live with the fallout of industrial civilization in our lifetimes. And the question will be basically how bad that will be. I mean, we're already in a situation where, like, hundreds of species are dying every day, massive deforestation, massive acidification of the oceans, and so on and so forth. We still don't even know how bad all those things are. I mean, there are some people that are saying the impact of the loss of biodiversity will end up killing humanity before global warming itself. So, I mean, we do physically have to continue to fight. We have to do everything we can to stop, you know, industrial capitalism. You know, this isn't like a nihilistic call to give up, but I would say that we have to realize that the idea that we can just, you know, kind of continue on as if, climate change may or may not happen. I mean, it is happening. It is unfolding. The question will be, how bad is it, and what will it look like when it gets, you know, a couple decades from now?
Yeah. Well, and I think, I mean, there's a number of points I want to make on this, but first, thanks for sending the letter. It's awesome. Everyone should send us letters if they feel like it. Hearing what people think is really critical to steer conversations like this. Secondly, I think one of the fallacies of a lot of the discourse around climate change right now is that it's very, very, very focused on the future impacts of climate change, right? And this has been the case for 35 or 40 years, ever since people really started talking about climate change, global warming, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I remember being very young in the 90s and having teachers talk about this stuff at school, right? So we've been talking about it for a long time, but it's always talked about on this level of, if we don't do something, this is what will happen. I would actually argue that we're past that point. We don't need to think about how do we prepare to live through climate disaster. We need to think about how are we currently coping with climate disaster, because that's something that's already happening, right? We saw it with Katrina in 2005. I think that the response that the anarchist community had in the United States, that was amazing. And still informs a lot of the work that people are doing now in really, really positive ways. And so that's one response. And organizations like Mutual Aid Disaster Relief and groups like that do really, really, really incredible work. And if you're interested in doing disaster relief, please hit up Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, and they'll talk to you, train you, help you get to where you need to go. They're really amazing. So we've also seen examples of climate-based political, I guess we call them disasters, happen already in the last 10 years, right? So the Syrian Revolution, one of the elements of that that a lot of people aren't super aware of is that the Syrian Revolution was actually a revolution started mostly in towns and sometimes cities, but cities that were very agricultural in their sort of economic centers, right? A lot of the first protests started off in relatively rural areas, right? Farming villages, places like that. And the reason was that the people that were living in those areas were already on the verge of extreme precarity. There had been a drought in Syria that was largely driven by the expansion of deserts in that part of the world. Agricultural yields were really low. Some state policies in the recent past, right before the revolution broke out, had privatized certain elements of the state, and it actually curtailed some social services. And so people in those areas were in a lot of ways responding to the conditions that they had been thrown into, partially because of climate change, right? So we've already seen these things play out in a lot of ways. What's going to happen is anybody's guess. It could be anything from, you know, take a small, there was a small town in Siberia recently where people started getting anthrax again because something like 300 years ago, there had been an anthrax outbreak and they'd buried a bunch of bodies in a mass grave and the anthrax had gone into hibernation because it was so cold. It was under the permafrost. But when the permafrost melted, the anthrax reactivated and people started getting anthrax infections again, right? It could be something like that. It could be these hyper-localized scenarios. It could be, you know, mass sea level rise. It could be the generalized heat death of the planet. We're not really sure. But I think the question that Desert raises and the approach that it proposes is really fascinating. So for anyone that hasn't read Desert, I highly recommend you go out and get a copy of it. Partially because one of the things that it's arguing is that the revolutionary project, as we understand that, has to completely realign its expectations, as well as its terrain of engagement, right? So it's no longer a question of saving the world, right? We're sort of past that point, or we're past a point where we could legitimately make the argument that that's realistic, right? But it also is making this kind of tertiary argument, which is that we can't also fall back into the sort of nice, clean way that fantasies around the apocalypse sort of wrap up all of these problems, right? So we have all these problems that are all created by humans. It's a relatively easy conclusion to come to that, well, the problems will just be over when all the humans die and the problems will kill all the humans. That's a very simplistic understanding, but it's not a realistic one. The reality is that we're not all going to die, that in fact, a lot of us are going to continue to survive, and that might look more or less horrible depending on how things play out. So really the big question of Desert is how do we realign the revolutionary project around realities of the world that we're fighting in, as opposed to anticipations of the world that we want to build? And I think that there's a number of places where we have to ask that question, not just around the environment. But that's definitely a conversation we had on a different episode, and we have like 45 minutes to talk about it.
Right. And I think, you know, if you want to read some interesting stuff in the New Yorker, there's an article called The Uninhabitable Earth. You might remember it. It had some photos of like hipster skulls fossilized and stuff like that. That scared a lot of people when it came out, I believe, a year ago. But that's got some kind of doomsday scenarios. I mean, I would encourage people, you know, read what's coming out of like NASA affiliated think tanks and stuff like that, that's talking about, you know, in 15 years civilization itself is going to collapse. Their kind of take on the situation is very interesting because their, you know, their end analysis is not just like, you know, in 10 years the Earth is going to be uninhabitable per se, but climate change and everything that it will bring, along with things like wealth stratification and stuff like that, and the creation of these mass urban centers, mega cities, as them and the CIA have been calling them, are just going to basically create a situation that just is going to like cause the state to crack, and that civilization itself is going to break down. Which, I mean, in some ways, in the level of climate change and like, you know, bad things happening is obviously bad, but at the same time, I mean, this is going to create opportunities for new and ungovernable forms of life. I mean, if you look at what happened in Puerto Rico over the past year or so, I think that shows several things that are going to happen. On one level, it shows just the degree in which the state does not give any shits, any fucks about anything. I mean, it's just like Trump shows up and throws you know, toilet paper at people's heads and stuff like that. I mean, FEMA amassing huge amounts of water and food and then not distributing them to the rest of the island. You know, a year after the hurricane hit, I mean, there's still not power and electricity on. Like, the schools don't have basic infrastructure. So there's that. I mean, the physical, like, you know, like, the state is starting to, like, wither away literally in some areas. And just like we've talked about before, I mean, this is a huge thing going on in the rest of the United States, but just, you know, not only like the breakdown of legitimacy of the state, but just kind of like these, you know, zones in which the state basically has essentially failed. I mean, if you, I mean, even look at like in Michigan in some areas with the fact like 5 years from now, I mean, they still have not fixed, you know, the water crisis in Flint, Michigan.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just, you know, these huge problems that continue to exist that like the state literally has the capacity and the resources to fix. It just chooses not to. So, but, you know, back to Puerto Rico. So you have that. So the failure of the state to essentially do anything, its only response. I mean, this is interesting because this, you know, aligns with what happened in Syria. But I mean, the other thing that the state did do, I mean, keep in mind that Puerto Rico is essentially ruled by like committee of people of colonial powers that like oversee the island because it's so in debt because of, you know, past economic crises, which is, you know, insane to begin with. But, you know, what they did do is they privatized even more of the infrastructure on the island in, you know, post crisis. So, I mean, they basically made things worse for everybody there. And this has led to massive protests and like a quite violent May Day. What happened last year, if you remember, those huge riots that broke out. But so there's that, and then also there's the growth of, you know, the Centers for Mutual Aid, people squatting buildings. Like Mutual Aid Disaster Relief has been involved in people putting in massive amounts of like solar infrastructure in like squatted buildings and stuff like that. So I mean, there is this kind of growth of this kind of anarchist alternative, which is great to see. On the other hand, there's also been like so-called quote anarcho-capitalists that have tried to move in to create like a libertarian paradise, basically saying like, oh, this land is essentially a failed state. We can move in and create like all these like tax shelters and you know, build up this huge paradise for rich Bitcoin miners and so on and so forth. There's been some interesting articles that have come out about those experiments. They've all basically failed and crashed and burned. But it's interesting that like those people see an opportunity as well. However, their so-called utopia totally failed. Whereas ours, I think, still kind of has some hope. But I think looking at things like Puerto Rico are very important because, I mean, that's essentially what's coming for the rest of us.
Yeah. Well, and it gets into another part of the letter, which was a question about skills, right? So what skills do people need to build up? I think to answer that question, we need to ask two additional questions, which is, what have people done in circumstances like this already, which was just touched on a bit with Puerto Rico? But also like, how did people cope with things in New Orleans? How did people in Flint or Detroit or, you know, Erie, Pennsylvania or Baltimore cope with financial crisis? Right. Cause in a lot of parts of the Rust Belt, people did fall back into mutual aid networks and, you know, DIY repairs for their refrigerators and stuff like that. And there's entire, networks of people in down and out Rust Belt cities that pretty much keep those communities afloat, because there's no resources, right? People have kind of responded in that way. In that sort of vein, I think a lot of what's going on in the sort of hardware hacking and maker scene is actually really, important for us to understand, right? So it's not that you're going to go out and make, you know, kitschy tables for your kitchen or something like that. But the skills that are involved in doing those kinds of things, welding, knowing how to do basic carpentry, learning how to use tools, are pretty, pretty important to surviving really rough situations. And a lot of those tools right now, especially if you live anywhere near an industrial salvage warehouse, a lot of those tools like drill presses and stuff are insanely cheap to buy. So if you have a little bit of extra room in a basement or something and a few hundred dollars extra, go build yourself a little workshop and just start learning how to tinker with stuff. It's pretty invaluable in contexts where there's just no resources to deal with crisis.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, one of the good things too, is that we live in a country where I think, you know, one of the few pastimes that like actually brings together, you know, kind of like, I don't know, like right wing prepper, gun enthusiast, you know, people that want to go hunting on the weekends along with, I don't know, farmers market liberals and stuff like that, is things like canning and like making your own medicine and kind of like these DIY either back to the land or prepper or survivalist type of stuff. Like, a lot of people across the spectrum, even though they might have different words for it, like, really like that stuff. And really like kind of learning those skills and being really affluent in them, like knowing the plants that are around them. And people also like saving money too. So when you combine all those things together, I think that you can start to think about some things that you and your friends could do. Mm-hmm. I mean, having things like having like a, you know, an integral herbalist in your local area that really is a total nerd and knows everything about herbs and plants and stuff like that, come out and doing like a workshop on, you know, everything in your garden that can help, and, you know, making basic remedies with herbs and stuff like that. I mean, people will literally come to that, and not just people that go to the health store every week, you know, to get their groceries, but just people in general that don't have access to a lot of money and like want to know that stuff. You know,
in a lot of cities, those communities, specifically around herbalism and like urban farming, specifically guerrilla farming, are actually really wildly diverse, right? They're not all white people. It's, you know, at least half people of color usually, and there's a pretty wide variance in income, right? So you definitely, in communities like that, you get your annoying upper middle class Trustafarian New Age hippies, but you also get some like just super practical people who live in these like down and out neighborhoods who have just been on the same street for 30 years, and they built up all this infrastructure in order to allow the people around them to survive, right? And that could be simple things like food exchanges, right? Where I live, there's whole structures in neighborhoods where, like, if you don't have any food, like if you can't afford food, you know the house you can go to, and they're always going to have a pot of soup in the freezer, just like ready to give to someone who doesn't have any food, right? So these kind of informal structures that would fall to me into the concept of skills, right? We need to build up skills to interact with people that might think differently than us or be differently, like live differently than we do, that don't exist in our bubbles, right? And so one of the biggest things that we can do as far as responding to climate change, as far as responding to the collapse of the political structures around us and the economic structures around us, is actually just learn how to be people first, right? That are also anarchists, but learn how to be people. Not activists that live this life that, you know, we don't interact with other people that aren't activists, but like be a person on your street for a little bit, build a community workshop so people have a place to go, like fix their stuff if it breaks, learn how to solder a little bit, help people in the neighborhood fix their computers, like do those things. So when we think of skill building, I think we often think of this stuff as skills that we acquire on our own in isolation. We should really be thinking about skill building on a community level, right? What skills are needed in our community, and what talents do we have as individuals, or interests do we have as individuals that can help fill those gaps? The more that we do that, the much more well prepared we are for what's going on right now, let alone what's going to go on in the future.
Yeah. Another idea would be if you live in an area, for instance, that has a lot of fruit trees or a lot of like extra citrus stuff, or if there's areas where there's orchards going around that you can like glean from, you know, getting people together to do like canning stuff, like, you know, can fruits and vegetables and excess things, put that away. I mean, that's another good thing people want to learn how to do, get good at. I mean, think about where your water comes from. You know, what's going to happen when the water system, like if we woke up tomorrow realizing that a Flint type situation was happening today, what would we do outside of going and buying bottled water? You know, all of that stuff. So I think that hopefully we've gone over a little bit about what could be the beginning of some sort of a strategy, but
yeah. Well, and a lot of these skills specifically, you can learn them on YouTube now, right? Yeah. Like we have this amazing advantage called the internet where you can just go out on YouTube and be like, how do I build a solar water distiller? And you'll just find 35 videos right away that are showing you how to do it. Really take advantage of that stuff, right? And even if you don't end up actually going out to build the thing, just understand the thought process behind how these things are built and made and thought through, and what materials you could scavenge, literally, not buy, but scavenge to make this stuff.
Right.
At least start to think through things that way.
And also, I mean, you know, think about the situations in which you're already starting to go through this. I mean, maybe you're in a point in your life where, you know, I don't know, you just got a house and your pipes don't work, you know, or they're too rusted and you have to start buying water. You know, what could you do to get out of that so you're not dependent on that resource anymore, that you're doing it yourself somehow? Or if there's even, you know, if there's even plants in your backyard that are medicinal, like how could you start using those? Just all those type of things. I mean, can, you know, I don't want to say it, it starts from within, but, definitely, you know, there's no shame in starting small and starting from your own experience.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, next we're going to turn towards, there was Vox just put out this video. It's about essentially how the news has a constant cycle that kind of avoids talking about policy, for example. So they use the example of the Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. And basically their argument is that no one's talking what is the Green New Deal. No one's talking about the problems that the Green New Deal is trying to address. And no one's talking about essentially the ways in which the Green New Deal may or may not address those problems. Instead, the discussion on either, quote, you know, the center liberal media or right-wing media like Fox, instead is basically just, will this legislation give the Republicans ammo? You know, will the base go for the Green New Deal? Basically, this kind of like partisan positioning or just kind of like boring inside political baseball, without really discussing the kind of the meat and potatoes of the legislation itself. And their argument is that basically this is how politics is talked about in the U.S. now, which is, according to them, a real detriment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was a very interesting piece. I think everyone should seek it out and watch it. And it points to a turn that happened in political discourse that I would point to the beginning of Politico as a major news outlet, as sort of being the catalyst of. So I myself am an obsessive reader of Politico. I have been for a decade because of this kind of dynamics of statecraft sort of stuff. But I'm also a politics nerd, so of course I'd be obsessed with Politico. But after that became popular, that sort of discourse, we saw kind of in the run-up to the 2008 election, almost all the news coverage was snippets from speeches and then discussions of political strategy. And that really was a sort of sea change, right? So like in the Vox video, they identify that sort of thinking, right? The sort of discussion around the strategy of politics, the strategy of statecraft, I guess is the way I would put it. They call that tactical framing, right? So tactical framing is a form of political discourse which centers almost entirely on the dynamics of policy, but without focusing on the content of policy, right? So in the Vox piece, like as we just went over, they sort of point out that this is a, you know, creates a source of partisanship, right? So it assumes a partisan lens in its very analysis, right? What are Democrats doing? How is the base going to respond? Blah, blah, blah. And it also imparts a sense of cynicism, right? So it reduces politics to kind of cynical tactics, right? And that all might be the case, right? I think any of us could look out into the world and see pretty clearly that a lot of the discussion has shifted into kind of a cynical discourse on political strategy. However, the critique of tactical framing, as it was articulated in the Vox piece, sort of relies on a series of assumptions that are in themselves really highly problematic, right? So first off, the critique sort of assumes the knowledge of policy debates on a policy level. It assumes that that actually has an impact on policy and that the discursive framing of a policy discourse in itself is then translated into policy modifications. So essentially what the argument is implying on its superficial level is that your neighbor's feelings on the Green New Deal actually matter, right? I think a lot of us like to think that they do. But if we look at basic things like climate change policy, right, or the war in Iraq, or healthcare, or, you know, name a dozen other things, student loan interest, whatever. These are all sort of policy questions that vast pluralities of the American populace are in agreement on, but they're in agreement on a position that is contrary to what the policy position is right now coming out of Washington. And so in those situations, I think it is incredibly clear that what us normal people, quote unquote normal people, so people outside of the political class, think about policy is generally irrelevant until it comes down to election time. There are exceptions to this, right? There are definitely moments in which certain people raising certain concerns about certain things at certain times have actually caused some changes in the way the policy will play out. But by and large, the people that are making those changes happen are lobbyists, political donors, people like that. They're not people like us, right? So the whole piece assumes a kind of purity of political discourse, that somehow we actually do live in the world that was assumed to exist in the late 18th century when the United States was founded, that really the government in the U.S., according to this vision, is a vast public forum, that all we're doing is kind of having these discussions, and we all have these discussions from a position of equality, right? But I think all of us know that that's completely a fiction. And even if it weren't a fiction, we still have this entire structure of representationalism, which assumes that individuals can represent the totality of all of their constituents, which is existentially impossible, but also simultaneously renders our individual feelings on policy irrelevant, right? So there's that problem. But I think that there's a deeper problem here. And that deeper problem is that their critique is relying on assuming that policy is the only legitimate form of engagement, and that discursive engagement, so engaging through discourse, through talking, debate, things like that, is the only legitimate terrain of engagement, right? And that's an assumption that goes back to the roots of liberal democracy. So if we look at liberal democratic states, the United States, France, Germany, blah, 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 they all function based in a mode in which they're assuming that the structure of the state is some absolute expression of sort of human universality, right? So in the United States, we call them inalienable rights, meaning that they're rights that precede existence, right? And in making that claim, the people that wrote these founding documents, regardless of what liberal democratic regime we're talking about, were making the argument that the form of the state, as they were setting it up, is a universally true political structure, and that all forms of engagement have to happen through that. Now, if we make that assumption, sure, tactical framing is entirely damaging, and it prevents us from having policy discussions within that world. But if we don't assume the legitimacy of that, if we assume that there are other forms of engagement that don't involve the state, then we start to run into a very different calculus. So when you start to think about an anarchist project, a project that is contrary to the state in its very definition, starting to understand the tactical dynamics of how the state functions is absolutely critical for us if we're ever going to transcend beyond a world of opinion and discourse and activism, which attempts to engage in discourse. If we're ever going to engage in actual disruptive or actual revolt, like actual disruptive activity or actual revolt, these kind of dynamics, which are, you know, referred to here as tactical framing, are absolutely critical for us to understand. That, in fact, if we don't understand them, we might as well not even try. We're dead in the water at that point, unless we get super, super, super lucky, essentially. And so when we're thinking about this kind of discussion about media dynamics, I think we really need to think about the question of why do we individually consume media, right? So like I consume media to understand specifically these kinds of tactical questions, rather than to understand whatever random thing Lindsey Graham decided to say about a policy that day. But different people have different goals, right? So I think the Vox piece kind of flattens all that out and tries to pretend that there's only one form of engagement on one terrain of engagement and assumes the state in the process. But I think that we can complicate this discussion a lot while still recognizing that this shift in media discourse has very much actually happened. And I really appreciate that the piece pointed that out so clearly.
Yeah, we're going to try to draw a line from that to something that's been going on with one of these far-right pro-Trump grifters, Jacob Wall, and also just kind of tie this into the changing culture at CPAC. CPAC, or, God, what does it even stand for? The Convention for
Action Conference.
Right, Conservative Political Action Conference. I mean, we've been meaning to talk about CPAC and kind of the culture there for a while. You know, it's going down. It's been writing about CPAC for couple years now, and I think it is important in some degrees to look at kind of what's coming out of there. I think, you know, for me especially, kind of like the outline that Bannon put out in 2017, right after the Trump administration came into the White House, I think was very clear as to what their goals were: economic nationalism, borders, and the destruction of the so-called administrative state. And I think also, too, just kind of Bannon's dream of uniting, as he said, you know, paleoconservatives with, like, the reactionary wing of the Libertarian Party with, you know, evangelicals, like, finding the piece, the reactionary pieces that could kind of, like, produce kind of a right-wing populist war machine, which I think is very important to look at. But so what happened with Jacob Wall exactly?
So Jacob Wall and Laura Loomer, so anyone that pays attention to the far right probably has heard the name Laura Loomer. She's – so for some background, Jacob Wall – and I know we brought this up before, but it definitely bears reiterating because it's so entertaining. Jacob Wall tried to create a controversy in which him and a right-wing lawyer named Jack Berkman, I think his name is. I might be wrong about that. It's something like that. Tried to throw a press conference where they claim to have a person who is going to speak that said that they were sexually assaulted by Robert Mueller on a specific date in New York City. Now, what was funny about that is not only did they send out a bunch of feelers out to a bunch of people that they thought that they could pay to sign an affidavit, which is entirely illegal to do. And then those emails then got forwarded onto the press. But Robert Mueller was actually in Washington, D.C. that day testifying in front of Congress and not, in fact, in New York City. So, of course, the press conference blew up. And that's when a lot of people in the United States became aware of who Jacob Wall actually is. He's a 20-year-old kid from L.A. He's been banned by the SEC from trading stocks because he ran a, like, scam mutual fund when he was in high school. But his dad is a powerful corporate attorney in Los Angeles and was a surrogate for the Trump campaign. So that's Jacob Wall. Laura Loomer is, I don't even know how to describe her, kind of a wingnutty conspiracy theorist who also does a lot of live streaming and, like, media stunts is kind of her jam.
She's kind of a lot like Jack Posobiec. She kind of rose to prominence in, like, 2016. Was kind of one of the people that had one foot in the alt-right proper and one foot outside of it. But then, you know, after Hailgate in late 2016, clearly kind of distanced herself a little bit from it. But, I mean, you know, I mean, she's been pictured with, like, Richard Spencer and kind of like been on the outskirts of that world and like had a lot of connections with people that, you know, could clearly be defined as white nationalists or the alt-right, but I mean, still kind of maintains that she's in fact, you know, part of the alt-right or the new right, or right. Just now she's kind of tried to just essentially rebrand herself as just like a pro-Trump person or MAGA or whatever. But she has just been involved in a variety of stunts, which she calls loomering, or yeah, kind of like, you know, weird investigative journalism where she just goes and, like, you know, live streams. I think the thing recently that she's been most known for is she went to Nancy Pelosi's house and she, like, climbed over the fence and also, like, hired these guys from Home Depot to help her. And they, like, set up a tent to, like, occupy Nancy Pelosi's house. And their whole point was, like, see, walls do work, Nancy. They could get in. It was just, like, some dumb crap.
Yeah. Their connection is that they both circulate these kind of right-wing conspiracy theory circles to varying degrees. And they're both really rabidly Islamophobic. And so they, in this specific circumstance, went to Minneapolis to try and promote the conspiracy theory that Ilhan Omar, the congresswoman from Minnesota, from Minneapolis, had married her brother for citizenship. Now, that rumor had been debunked easily a year ago, but that Jacob Wall is trying to
And it's, like, so obviously a remix of birtherism. I mean, it's literally the same crap.
That is entirely what it is, mixed with Islamophobia, right? So they go to Minneapolis, into a Somali neighborhood in Minneapolis, which, if people listening to this aren't familiar, Minneapolis has a very large Somali community. So they referred to it
as a no-go zone.
Right. They referred to it as a no-go zone. They were going to try and film, like, you know, people that they identified as Muslim being mean to them or something. So anyways, at some point in this process, Jacob Wall went to a Minneapolis police department station to report a death threat from another Twitter account. Now, what's interesting about this other Twitter account, though, is that every journalist that's looked into this other Twitter account is absolutely 100% positive that the Twitter account itself was also set up by Jacob Wall, and that was actually confirmed by one of the people that went to Minneapolis with him. So essentially what he had done, and this is very typical Jacob Wall kind of activity, he had sent himself a death threat over Twitter, claiming to be a social worker in Minneapolis, and then printed it out and filed a false police report at a police station in Minneapolis as a way to try and get publicity. This is at least the fourth or fifth time Jacob Wall has done something which is a felony, and no one seems to ever want to call him on it, but he definitely did that. Since he's done that, a couple of people that had worked with him have abandoned him very publicly and said, this kid doesn't know what he's doing, he's going to get people in trouble, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, so Jacob Wall is this kind of creature of a world of constant campaigning, right? So he arises in the kind of Trumposphere as a person who is known for being the first person to respond to any tweet that Donald Trump writes. So if you actually, Jacob Wall has now been permabanned from Twitter, so you won't see this anymore. But if you go back into the Twitter archives, you will often see him being the first person responding to Trump, any tweet that Trump makes. And it's usually something super generic and relatively short. And he used that to build up his audience. So what we're looking at is we're looking at a political scenario in which politicians are always campaigning, right? There is no more period of time anymore. And I know that this has been a running joke in the United States for a long time, but it actually is very true. There hasn't really been much of a time in the last 6 or 7 years where there hasn't been political campaigning happening. Even if it's just preparatory campaigning, there's still campaigning going on all the time. And definitely in the age of Trump, that is something that is absolutely happening. Donald Trump is 100% in campaign mode, 365 days a year, every single year. And in that process, what he's doing is he's constantly whipping up his base. And that creates the conditions for a person like Jacob Wall, who is unknown, some random 20-year-old rich trust fund kid from L.A., to become prominent. Because there's this heightened energy all the time. There's this kind of partisanship that builds up all the time. And people like him have learned how to exploit that pretty effectively, right? So anyways, yeah, that's Jacob Wall. That's what he did in Minneapolis. That's how it connects to permanent campaigning. Yeah, anyone that wants a really entertaining evening, just go look up some of the stuff Jacob Wall has failed at trying to do, because he's really bad at this, and it's, like, super comical.
You know, just two things I want to comment on CPAC. One thing on CPAC and then one thing on Identity Europa, just to kind of add my 2 points in here. You know, CPAC was interesting this year where they actively, like, they didn't allow Patrick McLovin Casey in from Identity Europa. You know, some of these far-right drifter types, like Nick Fuentes, was not allowed in. He was actually chased by security. Like Jacob Wall, when he did his press conference, he had to do it outside of CPAC, and they actually put, like, a security person in there so he didn't, like, move into the conference. And, like, it was very clear he was not with CPAC. So, I mean, they've done that, but at the same time, I mean, the white nationalism, like, segments of the alt-right talking points, at least to a degree, kind of a whitewash version of them, have definitely become mainstreamed within, you know, CPAC and, like, you know, quote, conservatism proper. And also just, you know, it is the party of Trump now. I mean, there's no debating that. That's what everybody kind of walked away from it was saying, was just that, like, this isn't about conservatism anymore. It's Trumpism. So I think, you know, we're seeing a definite shift in that, you know, the party has rebranded itself. It's kind of opened itself to the alt-right, but it's, you know, really kicked out a lot of the people that just have so much baggage, or they're just too stupid, or, you know, they don't look good. You know, they are associated with Unite the Right or neo-Nazism. I mean, those people have been kicked to the curb because they're just not worth it. Well, but at the same time, the ideas have been, you know, solidified very much so within the party, which is, you know, I think what everybody would have expected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we were saying this in November. We were talking about the midterms, is that the real question that is arising now is how does the Republican Party simultaneously absorb Trumpism and get rid of the alt-right? Because the alt-right's outlived its usefulness now to them. And to the people that are the actual strategists, people like Frank Lutz and people like that inside the Republican Party who make their living doing political strategy. They don't have any need for those people. They have need for those people when they're useful, and they don't have any need for them when they're not anymore. And so people like Jacob Wall are a liability. I think the biggest question that's going to come out of what happened at CPAC, because as you stated, I think the most interesting part of CPAC wasn't even to me so much the way that Trumpism dominated CPAC this year, because even last year was kind of this mix of like traditional conservatism and Trumpism. But this year was really the year that Trumpism was the only framework of politics that was being talked about. I think what was really fascinating in that context was watching who was picked as a winner and who was jettisoned as a loser in that process, right? So there were a lot of people from, say, like Turning Point USA that are absolutely reprehensible, awful, horrible human beings that were allowed into CPAC just fine. Never had the credentials question. But people like Laura Loomer, Jacob Wall, Patrick Casey, people like that got tossed. There were a number of other names that I heard too that I've since forgotten.
But I have a feeling that like Laura Loomer is not making bank, you know. Whereas people like Charlie Kirk, I mean, they're backed by the Koch brothers.
Yes, absolutely. And so it seems like what?
Can I just say a fun fact I learned the other day?
What's that?
There was in the 70s and the 80s, there was a group called the Libertarian Youth Alliance. It was basically like modeled after the Students for a Democratic Society, but it was Students for a Libertarian Society.
Totally.
And it was actually pretty active on campus groups, but it was mm-hmm. Designed to basically be kind of like Turning Point USA is, but it like was very anti-war to some point. But it was backed by, and it, in fact, like kind of back some progressive stuff like gay liberation and things like mm-hmm. that. But it received a lot of money from the Koch brothers. Mm-hmm. But at one point, some group within the wider organization issued something in support of the White Knight riots in San Francisco. And this caused the Koch brothers to stop giving them money, which I thought was hilarious. So, I mean, again, I think this shows what anarchists have always said about, you know, nonprofits and stuff like this. But this shows mm-hmm. it on the right in that... Yep. When a student organization backed by the elites takes a position in which they back, you know, genuine proletarian activity, you know, people mm-hmm. rioting, you know, that support gets cut off very quickly. You see kind of where support starts and where it stops. I just thought that was hilarious.
The other thing that this kind of picking of winners and losers has demonstrated, just like with Turning Point USA, Daily Caller also, and our articles were just coming out today. Talking about how the Koch brothers, the Koch Foundation, was the biggest funder, institutional funder of the Daily Caller Foundation, which is the nonprofit arm of Daily Caller, in 2016 and 17, and I would imagine that also continued into 2018. It's available for that. So what that means, though, is that the Koch brothers have chosen Daily Caller as a winner. But they've chosen Patrick Casey as a loser, right? Not just the Koch brothers, but the entire Republican donor class, which really funds to a large degree CPAC and everything kind of associated with CPAC. That's how you get like TPUSA still being considered legitimate, even though one of their organizers made comments sympathetic to Hitler recently. Their internal chats that have been leaked have pointed to like overt racism.
They've had two organizers that have been on tape talking about, I hate effing black people and stuff like that.
Right. So, what we're seeing now, though, is we're actually seeing a process happening in the Republican Party, which is very similar to what usually happens in the Democratic Party. So traditionally, the Republican Party, and I mean traditionally in the sense of up until the last 15 years or so, the Republican Party existed in this sort of mode in which they knew that the far right was there. They tried not to interact with them directly at all. But they would echo some of the talking points in their kind of media sphere, right? And then try and utilize moderate versions of those talking points. But they wouldn't have any direct correlation with them. The Democrats, on the other hand, have always had this process in which they build their campaigns based on the kind of autonomous, like grassroots political activity that's happening, and then pick and choose people within those kind of political networks to adopt into the Democratic Party and create this process, this discourse of like good protesters and bad protesters to reduce it down to terms that we would understand, right? And they go, well, all the communists and anarchists and stuff, they're all bad, so we won't work with them. But this person that was in those groups that did some environmentalist stuff with us in this other coalition, we're going to try and convince them to come and work with us, right? And that seems to be what the Republicans are doing now, is they're taking this more nuanced understanding, this more nuanced approach to their own grassroots. And that grassroots for the Republican Party does include the far right. And I think that what they're doing is they're trying to start to mobilize kind of constantly on the grassroots level, utilizing these organizations as a sort of engine, and then be able to pick winners and losers just like the Democrats do. That's what I really saw at CPAC. And that is really kind of an approach that a lot of people within the Republican establishment have taken to addressing or dealing with Trumpism, right? That they want to incorporate Trumpism into what they're doing because it gives them strength, but they don't want to be overwhelmed by it, and they don't want to be delegitimized by it. And so a lot of what we saw at CPAC was this attempt of an already existing conservative establishment to embrace the thing that they know is popular while getting rid of all the things that would end up damaging their future political prospects. And that's a very Democratic Party approach.
Yeah, I think the other thing that's interesting, if you look at, for instance, Identity Europa, they recently rebranded themselves as American Identity Movement, and they released kind of their, you know, 5-point program. And it was basically Trumpism 101. It was protectionism, you know, seal the borders. I don't remember what else it was, but it, you know, one was identitarianism. But essentially, it was nothing left of the dial that would have risen any eyebrows for, you know, just a mainstream Trump supporter or MAGA Muppet. You know, in fact, the only word that kind of would arouse any suspicion that they were white nationalists, you know, out and out, was the fact that they used the term identitarian.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, obviously, I think this is by design. But what I find interesting about this is essentially the alt-right, you know, at least with this group, has jettisoned any sort of, you know, quote-unquote progressive economic assumptions or a desire to address the problems of capitalism, you know, even for white workers. And instead, it now is specifically trying to engage their group with basically college Republicans in the GOP, which I think is, you know, for them is very strategic. And, you know, that's probably, you know, where the most of them think they're going to, like, you know, get involved in. Although now that all their members are doxxed, I mean, good luck to them. They're going to have a hard time continuing forward. But I mean, it also just shows that they are basically giving up, you know, the entire, you know, field to everybody else that actually is going to address the fact that capitalism is destroying the planet and everybody else.
Yeah, it also means Matt Heimbach lost that argument in the white nationalist movement, right? Because he was really pushing this really heavy focus on anti-capitalism along with white nationalism and traditionalist workers' party, and then later NSM for a month or however long he was in NSM. Anyways, but I think there's lessons to be learned from what happened at CPAC here for us, right? First is that the alt-right as a force which is capable of having legitimate political power in the sense of, like, achieving political office on its own without having to engage in entryism is over. They were subsisting for a really long time based on the notion that they were just a bit to the right of the Republican Party. But now that at CPAC they were rejected, essentially, it's going to be a lot harder for them to be able to claim the mantle of legitimacy going forward from here, even within the conservative movement, right? And it wasn't just kind of liberal papers or, like, super wonky political news outlets and stuff that were covering who was getting thrown out of CPAC. It was the right-wing media, too. So it's like all these people now know, anyone that pays attention to the right-wing media also now knows that Patrick Casey got thrown out of CPAC because he sucks. And that's a pretty important shift to happen, because keep in mind, it was just 4 or 5 months ago that Fox News was essentially trying to adopt the Proud Boys as a cause. And what happened at CPAC pretty much ends that. And that's important. I think the other thing that we can learn, though, for us is what happens when we try and engage with liberals, right? Because what happens to us is very similar to what happened to the alt-right at CPAC just now. And any of us that have been involved in anything that calls itself a social movement or any kind of grassroots political activity with people that aren't all anarchists, right? So in kind of popular frontish sort of initiatives, there almost always is a time in which some liberal or someone from some socialist group tries to throw all the anarchists under the bus. It's happened literally every time I've ever tried to do that, and I've been doing this stuff for 20 years because we're no longer convenient for them. And so when you hit the point where there's actual inertia and the Democrats actually think that they can sort of hijack that into electoral success, they throw us out as fast as they possibly can. And we saw that in a lot of places during Occupy, where all of a sudden it built up momentum. And then, you know, SEIU crawls out of the woodwork and the liberals crawl out of the woodwork. And all of a sudden they're funding everything and they really don't want anything to do with us anymore. Because we're no longer convenient for them, because we don't campaign for them and we don't vote and we don't do those kinds of things. We're not useful to them. So if anyone wants to know generally what happens when anarchists try and work with liberals in the vast majority of circumstances in anything that gets legs or builds up any inertia, just look at what happened to the alt-right at CPAC, because you can see those dynamics playing out literally in real time as they were trying to get into the conference and thrown out. That's a cautionary tale for us. We need to really learn lessons from that. And we should have been learning those lessons for a long time. And I think for periods of time we have. But right now, where there's so much possibility for popular rage, we need to be very, very, very careful of which allies we choose. Let me just put it that way.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.